Chapter 5. Our Little-Known Allies. During the next week, August 3rd through 9th, IA Feature grew into a full-fledged covert action program. The principal allies, Mobutu of Zaire, Kaunda of Zambia, Roberto of the FNLA, and Savimbi of UNITA were briefed and their cooperation assured. Paramilitary and organizational specialists flew to Kinshasa, and the task force took form. The third C-141 flight was launched, and in long working sessions of CIA paramilitary and logistics officers, the composition of the shipload of arms was carefully formulated. 12 M-113 tracked amphibious vehicles, 60 trucks, 20 trailers, 5,000 M-16 rifles, 40,000 rifles of different caliber. Footnote. Some of these were diverted to Mobutu's army in Zaire. End footnote. Millions of rounds of ammunition, rockets, mortars, recoilless rifles, etc. The U.S. Navy would bill the CIA $500,000 for the use of the American Champion. Strategic and tactical radio networks were devised for use by the FNLA inside Angola. Mobutu's army and air force hauled enough arms for 2 infantry battalions and 9 Panhard armored cars to the FNLA base at Ambriz, 70 miles north of Luanda. Senator Dick Clark, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his staff aide, Dick Moose, were briefed by Colby on the eve of their departure for Central Africa on a fact-finding mission. The CIA continued briefing congressional committees about the Angola program. Another 40-committee meeting was held on August 8th. The situation in Angola was deteriorating rapidly. The MPLA controlled 12 of 15 provinces and was gaining momentum. A radio station in Luanda boomed MPLA propaganda. The FNLA was trying to mount an offensive. Roberto and President Mobutu were pressuring the Kinshasa station. The Kinshasa, Lusaka, and Luanda stations bombarded headquarters with requirements and reports. Every CIA activity, no matter how trivial, eventually crystallizes onto paper in the form of a cable or memorandum. In the Angola program, the flow of paper was staggering. None of us had ever seen so many high-priority cables or memoranda to the director, the State Department, the Department of Defense, and the 40 Committee. One cable would arrive from the field urgently requiring an answer, only to be superseded by another more critical, and that by yet another. The cable system worked much faster than we did, which frustrated me at times, but also renewed my appreciation for the CIA's worldwide communication system, its heartbeat. Cabled messages arrive at the CIA headquarters building from radio relay stations around the world. While in the air, these messages are protected by a code which the agency hopes the Soviets cannot read. Machines at the transmitting field station automatically encode the messages, and computers on the first floor of headquarters decode them. Operators sit before the coding machines and guide them by typing signals into a keyboard. On receipt, incoming cables are reproduced automatically, some with several hundred copies, others with as few as 1 or 2, depending on the classification and controls. Inside headquarters, the cables travel by pneumatic tube to the registry section in each division, where the designating slugs are hastily read to determine which branch has action responsibility for each cable. The cables are then sorted into vertical trays for pickup by secretaries from each branch. Inside the branches, they are distributed to the appropriate desks, and one copy is put on the reading boards for general interest within the branch. The speed with which the system operates is breathtaking. For a flash or critic cable, the appropriate computers and lines are held open while all other traffic stops until the message comes through. A chief of station in any corner of the world can report a crisis or disaster to the division chief in 7 minutes, no more time than it takes him to draft the text. Immediate cables are generally delivered within 1 or 2 hours. Priority, within 6 hours, and routine within 12 to 24, depending on the volume of other traffic. For all the technical marvels of the cable system, it is still run by fallible human beings. CIA officers know that security liabilities lie in the human activities on each end, the disposal of classified trash, the guarding of offices and safes, and the care and discretion of those who know about the cables and the operations they represent. The reading boards can be a weak spot in the cable system security if the branch's senior secretary is sloppy. In my first branch, where I sat as an interim junior officer trainee, immediate cables and dispatches were arriving daily from an African post that was trying to recruit a Soviet. The chief of station had managed to persuade a young American couple, representatives of a large American corporation, to encourage an alcoholic 50-year-old KGB officer in his amorous pursuit of the wife. The COS, who had a flair for writing and a sense of drama, reported in detail the Soviet's advances, the wife's ambivalent reactions, and the husband's confused hostility. For a period of weeks, this made good reading. The branch chief's secretary gossiped with a stream of jolly voyeurs who came from all over the building to read the latest episodes. The branch chief, a jovial GS-15 who had never served an operational tour overseas, enjoyed the publicity his branch was getting. He would stand in his door and beam at his visitors as if holding a reception. Eventually, KGB security became aware of the affair, conceivably from a leak at CIA headquarters, but more likely because such liaisons inevitably become conspicuous in a little African post. The KGB officer was last seen being escorted aboard a Moscow-bound commercial jet by two KGB security officers. Some months later, the American couple was reported to be in marital discord. By then, no one at CIA headquarters outside the desk itself was reading the traffic or cared. Over the years, the CIA devised a special language, cableese, for use in cables. Originally, this was done in the interests of brevity, when field operators had to decode each letter from a one-time pad. The modern machinery is computer-fast and charges no more for additional words, but cableese still must be learned by newcomers to the clandestine services, who also face a strange vocabulary of cryptonyms and cable slugs. All cables are read and edited by a succession of supervisors until they reach the division chief, who releases them. In the CIA, one's cable writing is anonymous, as all cables go out from the director. One especially significant operational cable was the immediate we sent the CIA station chief in Luanda on August 7th. It instructed him to brief the Consul General, G.P. Swish, on the IA feature program. Simultaneously, the State Department sent a message through a special channel called the Roger Channel, which it used exclusively for sensitive messages about the CIA, advising G.P. Swish that he would receive an important briefing from the CIA station chief. This would make it clear to Swish that the State Department endorsed the Angola program, yet it would not expose any details to the State Department communicators in Washington or in Luanda. Potts and Bantam repeatedly massaged the cable until they were satisfied. The briefing would inform G.P. Swish of the fact that a paramilitary program was being undertaken in Angola with the approval of the 40 Committee and the highest levels of the United States government, and that it was highly sensitive. Ambassador Sheldon Vance, temporarily in Kinshasa, and Ambassador Wilkowski in Lusaka were the only officials outside of Washington who had been briefed. The presidents of Zaire and Zambia, Mobutu, and Kuanda were involved. This much was true. But the cable then proceeded to describe the program in less than candid terms, designed to soften the blow on G.P. Swish. It admitted that the program would support Roberto and Savimbi, but claimed that it was designed to promote a peaceful solution in Angola. Funds were being provided for Roberto, Savimbi, and Mobutu, but there was to be no direct provision of materiel to the Angolan groups by the CIA. It was a resupply operation to Mobutu's army, which had been selling arms to Roberto, and there was an understanding with Mobutu that no CIA arms would go directly into Angola. In sum, it illustrated the CIA's willingness to deceive a State Department principal officer in a war-torn post that was controlled by our enemy. In this case, the MPLA. Obviously, our arms would not promote a peaceful solution. They added fuel to the bloody conflict. And it was more than a resupply operation. From the first airplane loads in July throughout the war, CIA officers supervised the transshipment of CIA arms directly into Angola. By the end of the second week, 10 days after I had come up from Texas, the task force was lodged in a small office which was vaulted, that is, protected by a combination of tumbler locks and electronic sensors. Once the vault was secured at night, any unauthorized entry, and even a movement as slight as a falling piece of paper, would trigger alarms in the Office of Security. I had been joined by 7 case officers, 2 assistants, and 2 secretaries. Among the officers were 3 of Bantam's protégés. One spoke Korean as a second language, another Japanese, and none was familiar with Africa. One of them advertised his special status by establishing banker's hours, coming to work as late as 10 a.m. and leaving around 5, making it clear that he had, quote, protection, unquote. The second spent hours filling, tamping, and lighting his pipe while visiting with anyone that walked past. The third joined Lara and others by plunging into task force activities, arriving early, staying late, and turning out good work. Thanks to their efforts, the task force was functional, and in time would even achieve a certain frantic efficiency. As I began to learn my way around Angolan matters, I became aware of a major problem. The glaring weakness of the program was a lack of information about our allies and about the interior of Angola. We were mounting a major covert action to support 2 Angolan liberation movements about which we had little reliable intelligence. Most of what we knew about the FNLA came from Roberto, the chief recipient of our largesse, and it was obvious that he was exaggerating and distorting facts in order to keep our support. We knew even less about Savimbi and UNITA. I planned to fill this intelligence gap by sending someone into the guerrilla base camps inside Angola. My first candidate for that mission was myself. On Friday, August 8th, the 40 Committee met to discuss Angola. We had spent the day before scrambling to get ready, preparing elaborate charts for Colby's use in explaining the progress of the program. We had worked for hours in Potts's office, devising a simplified yet upbeat presentation, laced with carefully chosen phrases to achieve a positive tone. The format for each chart was initially handwritten on scratch paper by Potts himself. Then we filled in the blanks with appropriate figures and details. The charts were to be typed onto 8 by 11.5 inch sheets of paper and delivered to Graphics, where a layout would be perfected and a 30 by 40 inch chart produced either by hand or by photographic enlargement and mounted on a professional poster board. It was a laborious, maddening process. Every time a chart neared final form, Potts would rewrite it or change the format, and we would start all over again. This routine had continued all day until 10 p.m., with Potts making major changes in his own originals 5 or 6 times. When he finally relented, I felt that the presentation made a strong case for what we had done so far. One chart showed, in contrasting colors, the estimated troop strengths of the 3 movements. MPLA, 20,000. FNLA, 15,000, with 2,500 attacking Caxito. UNITA, 4,000. White Angolans with the FNLA, 20. Roberto had repeatedly claimed to have 30,000 troops, but we had arbitrarily halved that figure because none of us believed him. Anyway, it would sound better, in view of Roberto's recent defeats, to keep the figure lower. Colby was to explain that we did not have accurate figures for the MPLA troop strengths. The accomplishments board was broken into military and political sections, and included such things as, quote, Mobutu persuaded to send FNLA 9 panhards and arms for 2 battalions, unquote, and, quote, 3 plane loads of arms delivered to Kinshasa, unquote. Colby would mention the size of these C-141 transports for emphasis. Under political, there were items like, quote, world sensitized to Soviet arms shipments, unquote, and, quote, Mobutu and Kuanda brought on board, unquote. Another chart laid out our budget for the $14 million. We threw in an attractive little map of Angola so Colby could show the committee members where Luanda and Caicedo and Ambriz were. We also included a briefing sheet of pertinent details for Colby's use. He ought to do well in front of a sympathetic committee. Potts would be there to back him up. Potts was in early the day of the meeting. I soon had the charts propped against the coffee table and chairs so he could see them. Potts looked them over slowly. I admired them as he went. Then it happened. Potts decided to change one of the lines on the accomplishments board, and he spotted a typographical error. We can't say that, he declared. It doesn't look right. I thought I told you... Well, sir, there's nothing we can do now. The meeting is at 9:30. Colby's car leaves at 9, and it's 8:15 now. But we can't use them like that. Take them back down to graphics. See what they can do. Sir, they can't change them now. There isn't time. It took them 8 hours to get these done. They always find a way. Go on, hurry. A director of CIA briefing of the 40 Committee was a historic event. Decisions would be made. Armies moved. People would die. And Colby would be calm and effective, appearing completely knowledgeable on Angola and Central Africa. He could not turn and point to a chart that had a typographical error. Of all its activities, the agency is the most conscientious and professional when preparing memoranda, papers, charts, or briefings for the White House or Congress. No agent operation will ever galvanize a headquarters office into such feverish activity as the announcement that it has to prepare a paper for the director or the 40 Committee. The papers which flow up through the chain of command are letter perfect, immaculately typed, and in the crispest form of Washington bureaucratic English. I rounded the turn into G Corridor, past the northeast entrance, and heard a police whistle shrill and a voice shouting, "Sir, sir, stop, stop!" I jerked to a halt. A woman guard rushed up to me, her hand on her pistol. "Where are you going?" she demanded. "Officer, I have to get these to the director and damn quick." "That's not the way to the director's office." "I know, but I have to go to graphics first." "You come to my desk. I'm going to have to get your name and badge number and check you out. You can't run in this building." "Officer, my name is John Stockwell. My badge is HW-469. You call the Africa Division Chief if you like, but I'm on my way." I turned and bolted, ignoring her calls after me. It gives me a funny feeling to run from any armed officer, even a CIA guard. I wondered if she would summon help and track me down. Of course, Potts was right. Graphics did the impossible. At 9 o'clock, the charts were corrected, and I delivered them to the director's office on the 7th floor, just as Colby walked out to meet Potts by the waiting elevator. Two of Colby's special guards, dressed in civilian clothes, turned quickly as I rushed up and watched as I handed the carrying case to Potts. One of the guards got into the elevator with Colby and Potts. They would ride non-stop to the basement, where another guard was posted, and then travel in an inconspicuous brown chauffeur-driven Plymouth sedan to the White House. I went back to Africa Division and the morning cable traffic. Almost immediately, Bantam called me in. He was beside himself, fuming and snatching at papers on his desk. I closed the door. "Look at this. Have you seen this?" It was a cable from Kinshasa proposing that we put 15 agency observer teams, Americans, at key locations in the interior of Angola. It argued that this was the only way we would get the intelligence and control we needed for a successful program. It outlined the airplanes, radios, and logistical support we would need to back up the teams. "Here we go. It's Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia all over again. 50 Americans now, 500 next month, 50,000 next year." I looked at him helplessly. What could I say? "That's just like St. Martin," Carl exploded. "Charging ahead." St. Martin was an old East Asia hand who had been brought into Africa Division by Larry Devlin after they had worked together in the Laos program. "St. Martin has always been that way," Carl went on. "He damn near closed down my branch in Saigon in 62. What happened was, we had approval to spend $8,000 on a Montagnard program, and St. Martin was supposed to deliver the money. I gave him the cash, and he took off in his car. But somewhere around Da Lat, he gave the money to a Vietnamese colonel for a different operation, all of it. Then he turned around, came back to Saigon, got into the cash box, took the rest of our U.S. dollars, every penny we had, and gave it to the Montagnards. My branch was closed down for 2 weeks while the accountants came in and did an audit. So what happened? Bantam looked thoughtful. He convinced us the Vietnamese colonel's activity was justified, and there wasn't time for approvals. Bantam shrugged. His anger was passing. St. Martin worked for me for 5 tours. We made a good team. With me keeping his feet on the ground, he ran some good operations. In some ways, St. Martin is the best operator in the business. A couple of times in Laos, when we were overrun and everyone was ready to quit, he literally led the way back in. He and I and Colby and Nelson, we all sort of grew up together in EA division. Carl looked down at the cable again. The terrifying thing is that Colby and Nelson might approve this. I'm going to draft a cable myself telling St. Martin to back off, and I'm going to see that they send it out. At 2:10, Potts and Carl and I walked down the hall and rode the elevators up to the 7th floor to brief the DDO. On the way, Potts told us the 40 committee had ordered the formation of an interagency working group to monitor the Angolan program. Senior representatives of the State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House would meet as often as necessary to supervise the CIA while it ran the program. Potts clearly resented this. At least the CIA will chair it, he said. We'll have all the meetings here. Won't have to be running downtown. Maybe if I make them dull enough, they won't come too often. Carl was silent. I knew from his earlier comments that his frustration over the agency's intervention in Angola was reaching a boiling point. In Nelson's office, we sat on orange-padded, wooden-framed chairs at one end of the large room. Nelson came round his desk and joined us to establish closer contact. He spoke quietly, but any stranger watching the meeting would have sensed his relative importance. He was a medium-sized man, about Colby's build, with bushy eyebrows and tinted glasses, through which he looked at me with sparkling, friendly eyes. His 7th-floor penthouse office was walled on the east by floor-to-ceiling glass, which provided too much bright sunshine for comfortable paperwork, and a view of the stately trees which lined the George Washington Parkway. Potts briefed him on the program, while Carl listened morosely, and I took notes. He reviewed the approvals, the projected budget, still $14 million, the flights of arms, and the relative troop strengths. He also summarized the meeting of the 40 Committee, which had approved the forwarding of arms to Savimbi and had ordered the formation of the interagency working group. The 40 Committee had also discussed the need for foreign advisors to bolster the African troops of our allies. Potts mentioned the decision to send one of the agency's prepackaged units of foreign weapons. Nelson listened, his eyes focused on the coffee table. When Potts finished, Carl took the floor. Now would be a good time for us to decide just how involved we want to get. We're sending some arms. We can let them do the rest for themselves. Nelson was still silent. Potts looked argumentatively at Carl. I watched all three. Nelson spoke. Gentlemen, we've been given a job to do. Let's not sit around wringing our hands. He paused and looked at each of us sharply from under his thick eyebrows. What is our next step? He asked. Potts was silent, thinking. Carl was out of it. Sir, I said, we've got to have a look inside Angola. We don't know enough about our allies. What do you suggest? We should have a first-hand report from Ambriz and Savimbi's base at Silva Porto. Potts gave me a reproachful look. Carl's face clouded even darker. I tried to ignore them, although their stares made me nervous. I knew Potts resented any subordinate taking the initiative, since Carl had heard me expressing reservations about the program only a week before. My enthusiasm in front of the DDO must have sounded self-serving, almost hypocritical. but I was determined to be the one to survey the situation inside Angola, and this was my opportunity to sell myself to the DDO. "We would want someone with an adequate military background," Nelson said. "Yes, sir, but also someone who knows Africa and can help us run the program back here. I understand you grew up in that part of Africa. Weren't you in the Marines?" "Yes, sir, infantry, reconnaissance, and Vietnam, upcountry." He looked at me thoughtfully, and then at the coffee table again. I could see that he was keenly aware of everyone in the room. "I suggest you proceed immediately to Kinshasa, and then go to Ambriz and Silva Porto. When you come back, be prepared to brief whomever is interested downtown." It was an order. My mind was already ticking off passport, shots, visas, reservations, cash. I should cable Kinshasa and Lusaka to let them know I'm coming. The Zaire embassy would be closed until Monday. The earliest I could get my visas and leave would be next Tuesday on Pan Am 151, the red-eye special from Kennedy. Potts took me into his office to work out the details. I would take a 2-man team of communicators and keep 24-hour radio contact with Kinshasa. He was worried about me or any other case officer visiting an Angolan combat zone, fearful of the secrets I could reveal if I were captured and interrogated. Hence the requirement for communicators and 24-hour radio contact. On Monday morning, shortly before noon, Bill Avery came into my office. He had flown into Washington the night before from Kinshasa, where he had been helping the station receive the first shipments of arms. He spoke softly, but his voice had a hard, impersonal ring. I knew him only by reputation as a senior SOG paramilitary expert. "I just briefed Potts and Carl," he began. "I thought you should also have my report." He and St. Martin had seen Mobutu 5 days before and spelled out the program to him. "Mobutu was pleased," he said. "It seemed to be about what he had hoped to get from the U.S., although he kept asking for more." "Mobutu is screwing up Zaire pretty good, you know," Avery continued. "He simply has no idea how to run a country." The program needed everything, all kinds of basic equipment, trucks, jeeps, artillery, mortars, anti-tank weapons, airplanes. This wasn't a very big war yet, but everyone was underestimating what we were getting into. Ambriz was 700 kilometers from Kinshasa over bad roads. There wasn't enough fuel, even if they had trucks. So far, Mobutu's Air Force was doing most of the hauling, but he couldn't be expected to risk his C-130s in Angola for long, and his DC-4 couldn't handle it all. Mobutu expected us to get some C-130s over there fast. And some boats. Potts had just given Avery permission to add a couple of the agency's high-performance Swift patrol boats to the shipload of arms to patrol the lower Congo River and attack coastal shipping between Luanda and Cabinda. Footnote. The Swift is a favorite CIA patrol craft of about 15 meters, which the agency used on Lake Tanganyika during the Congo operation of the 1960s, and also in Southeast Asia. End footnote. I had been up and down the lower Congo River several times on ocean freighters, before there was regular commercial air traffic between the United States and Central Africa. And once, on a U.S. Navy ship, I steamed 200 kilometers upriver to Matadi, where the channel was broken by falls. From there, you rode electric trains through the mountains to Kinshasa. All surface freight goes in by this same route today. Near its mouth, the river flows along the Zaire-Angola border, with the shipping channel actually in the Angolan half, making this vital link with the outside world, like the Benguela Railroad, subject to Angolan control. Boats and coastal steamers ply a lazy trade up and down the Atlantic coast, and agents were reporting that the MPLA was constantly shipping arms from the Congo, Brazzaville, to Luanda. Footnote. The French Congo and Belgian Congo both assumed the title Republic of Congo at independence in the early 1960s. In 1971, Mobutu changed the name of the Congo, Kinshasa, to Zaire. End footnote. "And one more thing," Avery said, choosing his words carefully. "The Kinshasa station has some problems, St. Martin is energetic and imaginative, but sometimes he gets carried away with enthusiasm. Headquarters should make its cables to Kinshasa crystal clear to avoid misunderstandings. If possible, you should keep St. Martin on a short leash. Jimmy Bartlett, the deputy COS, is steady as a rock. That will help. Avery went on to suggest we keep the other members of the Kinshasa station out of it. Run it with temporary officers who could be yanked out when it was over. And Kinshasa needed help right away. Air operations officers, ground, maritime, logistics, and finance officers. They desperately needed infantry training officers because no one in the area knew how to handle the weapons we were sending. How about you, I said. Would you be willing to go back? He looked morose. I suppose I would. This is the only war we've got right now. Next morning, I took my suitcase with me to work, ready to travel. At 1 p.m., a secretary drove me to Dulles in her Nova. On the way, she handed me my worn black diplomatic passport, my tickets, and $1,500. How did you get the money? I asked, counting it. I signed your name over at State. Forgery? Just be glad I didn't sign for $3,000 and keep the rest. She also handed me a slender notebook, which looked at first like an ordinary checkbook. Inside was a pad of edible, water-soluble rice paper, which, supposedly, I could gobble down if I were captured. I asked her what my Angolan hosts were supposed to think when I consulted my checkbook in the Angolan hinterlands. For her benefit, I tore out a page and masticated laboriously until I could finally swallow it. Like many OTS, Office of Technical Services, gimmicks, this was a classroom toy, which had little use in the field. A case officer hardly wants to make irreplaceable notes on paper that dissolves at the slightest touch of sweat or rain, and I had little confidence in the ability of this paper to fulfill its intended purpose. I had once presented an agent in training with a similar pad. By way of demonstration, I had torn out a page and dropped it in my gin and tonic. For the rest of the meeting, it had floated buoyantly, unaffected by the liquid. Attached to the pad was an ordinary-looking Bic ballpoint, impregnated with esoteric writing chemicals. With the point retracted, I could write secret messages, which the Kinshasa station could develop by spraying on certain chemicals. I clipped it to my jacket. At least it was a functional ballpoint. I got on the eastern flight to New York, broke. No one had made arrangements to pay the $2,300 air freight charges for our 16 boxes of radio gear, and we all chipped in from our travel allowances. Even so, I had the same peaceful feeling you get after you leave the plane on a tactical parachute jump. Behind are hours of tedious preparation. Shortly, we'll begin another exhausting ordeal. But for the moment, your chute is open, you're safe, it's quiet, and you've nothing to worry about. The task force was looking good, and this trip was going to be bloody interesting. I dozed all the way to New York.